let everybody know, I'm going to need to end class a little bit early today. That's not something I ever want to do, but today, as hopefully people are aware, is Yom HaZikaron, the Remembrance Day for fallen soldiers, as well as those murdered in terror attacks. And there's a program here at the school, a memorial that I want to be a part of. So I'm going to need to end a little bit early today, and then if we need to, make up the time on a separate session. But that's also why I'm not what I hope is my usual smiling self. Right now, it's just not the day for it, so I apologize. This is the first of three classes on a story called in Hebrew Magilei Tzedek. English is Circles of Justice. There's going to be a lot for us to talk about throughout this, throughout this 3 weeks. Like you could go on forever about this story. I hope that people had a chance to download what I sent in advance, both the story and the source sheet. I'm going to post the link for the source sheet in the chat now. Hang on 1 second. So those who don't have the source sheet yet can download it there. I'm going to share screen when I read out the mission of the stories so that people could actually read along with me if they didn't get a chance to download the story. There's so much to say. So I'm going to dedicate our learning today for Yom HaZikaron, for the soldiers who fell, for the victims of terror, and specifically, as Susan mentioned, Mayor Ben Avraham Vissara, Mayor Wise. So let's talk a little bit first about Shai Agnon. Shai Agnon was not born Shai Agnon. His given name was Shlomo Yosef, and his surname, his family name, was Tchotchkes. So Shlomo Yosef Tchotchkes was born in the Ukraine, actually, in 1888, the town of Buchach. His father was an ordained rabbi, but not professionally rabbinic. He was in the fur trade. Agnon learned in cheder, traditional schools, until age 9. After that, his father took over. He learned Torah, and he also learned Haskalah. He had secular studies as well. At the age of 8, he started to write in Hebrew as well as Yiddish, poetry and stories. At the age of 15, he published a poem about a Kabbalist known as Yosef de la Reina. In the year 1908, so he's 20 years old, he moves to Yafo. I'm just going to mute people by default. Getting some background noise. There we go. In the year 1908, he moved to Yafo, to Jaffa. He actually tried his hand first at farming. That didn't work out, for which we are all grateful, I suppose. He found great success as a writer. His first published story in Israel was called Agunot, like the term Aguna that people are familiar with, and he took his pen name of Agnon from Agunot, from that title. He met other writers, Chaim Nachman Bialik in particular, while he was there. He attended public lectures by Rabbi Avram Yitzchak Cook, who was the chief rabbi in Yafo, in Jaffa at that time. Not clear exactly what Agnon's observance was at that point, his religious observance. He considered himself something of a student of Rav Cook, and it comes up in some of his writings. However, in 1913, he escorts Arthur Rupin of the Jewish Agency on a trip to Germany, and he stays. He met his wife there, Esther Marx. He was supported by a patron, Zalman Shokin of Shokin Books. He was close, as I said, with Bialik. He was also close with Asher Ginsberg, who was also known as, what's Asher Ginsberg's pen name? Anybody know? Right, I see Janine saying it, but you're muted. Achad Ha'am. Yes, Achad Ha'am. So he's there in Germany through World War I, and then he comes back to Israel in 1924. He moves to Talpiot. At that point, he builds a home in Talpiot. It is destroyed in the pogroms of 1929. If you're familiar with what went on in Hebron, it wasn't just in Hebron, it was elsewhere in the country as well. He rebuilds, he continues writing. Side note, particularly relevant with today being Yom HaZikaron and tonight being Yom HaAtzma'ut, it's been discovered that at the request of Chief Rabbi Herzog, Agnon was involved in editing the prayer for the State of Israel. There was an article about this on Times of Israel a couple of years ago about the research that disclosed that. On December 10th, 1966, Agnon and Nellie Sachs were awarded the Nobel Prize in Literature. This is before Saul Bellow, Isaac Bashevis Singer, you know, Bob Dylan, Jewish writers. He seems to be the first to be awarded the Nobel Prize in Literature. And, you know, I've heard people comment that it's a good thing they did it in 1966, because after 1967, it never would have happened. They never would have given it to an Israeli. But he got it. If you take a look at source number one, when I talk to people about Agnon, I always love to quote Agnon's Nobel Prize in Literature, his speech, his acceptance speech, delivered in front of, you know, the King of Sweden, which impresses me very much. Look at the opening of his speech. He says, and I posted the link again in the chat for the source sheet, it is said in the Talmud, from Sanhedrin, in Jerusalem, the men of discrimination did not sit down to dine in company until they knew who their companions were to be. So I will now tell you who am I, whom you have agreed to have at your table. As a result of the historic catastrophe in which Titus of Rome destroyed Jerusalem and Israel was exiled from its land, I was born in one of the cities of the exile. You see the dramatic way that he presents himself, right? Because Titus of Rome did this in the year 68 or the year 70, I was born in 1888 in the Ukraine. But always I regarded myself as one who was born in Jerusalem. In a dream, in a vision of the night, I saw myself standing with my brother Levites in the Holy Temple, singing with them the songs of David, King of Israel, melodies such as no ear has heard since the day our city was destroyed and its people went into exile. And that's the way he saw his stories, like the songs of the Levites. I suspect that the angels in charge of the shrine of music, fearful lest I sing in wakefulness what I had sung in a dream, made me forget by day what I had sung at night. For if my brethren, the sons of my people, were to hear, they will be unable to bear their grief over the happiness they have lost. To console me for having prevented me from singing with my mouth, they enable me to compose songs in writing. And that's, like I said, the way that he views his stories. This is the beginning of his speech. You can see it online if you follow the link in source number one. You can see the full text of his speech. He's truly remarkable in every way. He wrote short stories, which is what we're going to be looking at in our series. He also wrote longer books on many themes. It's not as though his writing is specifically about Jews, even though the stories take place in the lives of Jews and Jewish communities. They reflect the broad human experience. But his themes are religion in connection to God. Zionism is a very big part, and we'll see that in this story. Jewish community. Both the, I guess I should say warts and all. Chassidim and Misnagdim. Very, very big in his writing. One side of his family was Chassidish, one side of his family was decidedly not, and that makes it into his writing as well. His stories are chock full of references to biblical text, to Midrash, to Talmud, to Jewish law, and we're going to note some of them as we go along. Key point to understand about Agnon's writing, nothing in an Agnon story is unintentional. He wrote and he rewrote and he rewrote incessantly. He has stories that take him 10 years before he publishes them. Many of his stories are surreal, and you'll see that our story starts out very grounded and then suddenly takes a left turn and veers into the distinctly ungrounded. the distinctly surreal. It's really fascinating to see what he does with this. So what I want to do is introduce the story a little bit, and then we'll read through the story with the translation that I linked for you in the email that I sent out, which is available in many places online. Normally, I would not share a published translation that's available for sale, but this is on quite a few websites, some Christian websites, interestingly, because they really like the Christian aspect of it. They're very into that. So that's why I posted it. Frankly, I'm not thrilled with certain aspects of the translation, and I'm going to pick out some of that. Some cases, in the interest of making it intelligible for people in English, they missed some of the key points in the Hebrew. So I'll try to show that along the way. And once we've gone through the story, which we're not going to complete today, especially because, as I mentioned before, I have to stop early, but then we're going to move on after the story to discuss the layers of meaning that are in the story. Clear so far? Questions, comments? Okay. So this story, in one sense, is like many of his stories. It's fairly brief. The Nobel Committee actually said that they awarded him the Nobel because of, quote, his profoundly characteristic narrative art with motifs from the life of the Jewish people. And that is certainly the case with this short story. He starts out by developing a memorable character and presents us the conflict, and then it goes off the rails. Just quick show of hands. How many people read it in advance? Okay, so I see a fair number of hands for people who have read it. Thank you. I think that will help. And as I said, as we go through it, I'm going to show you how he weaves in biblical text, Midrash, Jewish law, although not so much as in other works of his, interestingly. I didn't see as much here. So, on a character level, this story is a beautiful story of sadness and consolation. If you look on your sheet at source number 3, number 2 is that link to where I posted the English translation for you. But number 3, from Gershom Scholem, Reflections on S.Y. Agnon, he makes reference to this story. He writes, Agnon began by writing short stories, and it is in this mode that he has achieved a perfection which leaves the reader breathless. More than 20 years of intense productivity passed before he published his first long book. The secret of their perfection lies in Agnon's compression of an infinite wealth of detail into infinitesimal space. Scholem, being the Kabbalist, loves that idea, right? You're compressing all of this into it's a Kabbalistic idea. Unsurpassed in this respect are his masterpieces of fiction in the third volume of his collected writings. Many of these tales are suffused with an atmosphere of immense sadness, while at the same time they hold out a promise of consolation. I'm skipping a little bit. Towards the end, he writes, another story concerns an impoverished vinegar maker, all alone in the world, who saves up diligently in order to make his way to the Holy Land. Uncertain as to where he should hide his money for safekeeping, he places it in an alms box under a crucifix on the road. Upon coming finally to fetch his cash, the vinegar maker is arrested for robbing sacred funds. Right? This is our story. He is imprisoned and condemned to die, but is visited in his cell by, quote, that man, Oto Ha'ish, right? As Yeshu is called in Hebrew, who takes him to Jerusalem, where he is found dead by his compatriots. For those who are not familiar, it's traditional to refer to Jesus as Yeshu. There is no prohibition in Judaism against calling him, you know, Jesus as well, but Yeshu is sort of the traditional way that we refer to him. Referring to him by his last name is another issue in Jewish law, but that's not the conversation right now. This story, beyond being a story about a character, is also a political story. And we're going to have to come back to that, but I want to note for you that it's published in 1923, when he is in Berlin, and then it is republished in a collection of Sipurei Eretz Yisrael, stories about Israel, It is a story about Polish Jewry on the one hand, which is reflected in its earlier edition, and it's a story about Zionism as well, as reflected in the later edition, and we'll see what that means later on. But for now, one thing to keep in mind is that this story, Agnon will end up saying, is somewhat about the Balfour Declaration. Keep that in mind as we read this story. Now, when the story is republished in the 1950s, it is received as Agnon flirting with Christianity. If you take a look at source number 4, this is my translation of an open letter sent to Shai Agnon in February 1960. This letter is talking to him. With its publication, D. Sadan, who was known then as Shtok, protested that it, the story, flirted with, quote, that man. Chaim Lieberman also mentioned you, Agnon, in a derogatory way regarding the battle regarding the alleged conversion of Shalom Ash to Christianity, which is its own story. Our master, Rabbi Yitzchak Isaac Herzog, chief rabbi of the State of Israel, asked that you recant from that story and bury it. Your established translator, Professor Kurzweil, could not find a satisfactory explanation for the story. This story will look like an embrace of Christianity, and we need to understand why. You can see why people would have that suspicion, though. For example, the title of this story, Magilei Tzedek, Circles of Justice, sometimes translated as Paths of Righteousness, where does that title come from? Where does that...
That's typical Christianity, isn't it?
No, where does it... It comes from a particular text. Yeah, Janine. It comes from Tehillim Chaf Gimel, Psalms, chapter 23, which, unfortunately for many Jews, they think of as the funeral psalm, because it's the one that's said at a funeral. It also makes it into Christian liturgy. It's the one with the line, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, that's the one. Well, that's what I was saying, that it's unfortunate that it's come to be known as a funeral psalm. It also, interestingly, in the Talmud, gets a vote to be Hallel at the Seder, but it didn't win. But it could have been many other things. But to Christians, they look at this and say, you named your story for something that's in our ritual prayer. Not only that, you will find in the story sets of three, quite a few sets of three. You're going to see that the main figure in this story is a vinegar maker. Well, vinegar apparently was offered to Yeshu on the cross. There's a lot more to be said, but I'm going to argue by the end of this series, you will see what I think Agnon is really doing, to use the modern word, is he's trolling. He's really trolling Christianity, and he's trolling the Jews who have put their trust in Christians. And that's going to go back to the Balfour Declaration, as we're going to discuss. So,
what's trolling? I don't know.
Pranking. It's what people do online when they need to find something else to do. It's where they're trying to get people upset and get them going. That's trolling. Agnon has a very, very sharp sense of humor. You have to know that about him, and you'll see it come through as we discuss this. There are a lot of papers about this story. It's really a story that aroused a lot of interest. So let's look at the story itself. We spent our first 18 minutes introducing it. Let's spend some time reading it. And again, I'm going to share the screen with the English translation so that people can read along with me if they did not get a chance to download it. You know from, you know, the last couple of years, I hate sharing screen. I'd rather see people. So if people could, between now and next week, actually download it and have it, then I would be able to go without that next week and I'd feel better. But for now, since not everybody had that opportunity yet, we'll do this. So this is the text of the translation that's available in various places online. And we're going to read it in sections. I'll read a section and then comment on it. In one of the towns of Poland, there lived an old man who used to make vinegar. His forebears were renowned wine merchants, but hard times impoverished them, and they left him with no more than a shack and wine that had gone sour. Never a happy day did he see there. His wife died when his children were small, and when they grew up, they were pressed into military service and died in the wars. The old man would sit there all alone and make vinegar. For the first 5 days of the week, he would engage in his trade, and on Fridays, he would fill up a large can and make his rounds about town. Many times, he would stop and think, "What am I? What is my life? 5 days a week, I make vinegar to sell? When I have sold it, I make some more and go out again to sell it. And for what reason? To sustain this enfeebled body. If my wife and children were alive, I would truly provide for them. Now that my wife is dead, my progeny is no more. Why do I take such pains to draw my skin from my flesh?" He would whine and sigh and moan about the course of his life so much that his work was discreditable in his eyes, and even the wearing of tzitzit and tefillin of little worth. But since the love of the land of Israel was embedded in his heart, he made up his mind to go up to the land of Israel. I'm actually going to pause there. That's actually where I wanted to pause first. By the way, I believe this was published by Toby Press. Just, I should give them credit for the publication. They've published a lot of Agnon in English. So we have a picture of a protagonist who is descended from wealthy wine merchants, but undescribed circumstances have made him a vinegar maker instead. Less lucrative. Exposure to the acid in the vinegar is bad for him. He loses his wife. He loses his children. His home is decrepit and falling apart, and we'll see more about that. Even his connection to God gives him no joy. But I want to highlight a few things here. So first of all, you may have noticed that in the English it said, "Hard times impoverish them," if you see that I just captured there. The Hebrew for that is not hard times. I'm just looking in my Hebrew version of it. The Hebrew is aval bitzok ha'itim yardu mi nichseihem. Now, why does that matter? Take a look at your source sheet, please. And you'll see that I quoted you a verse from the book of Daniel. Chapter 9 in Daniel. And I gave you the Hebrew also because otherwise, it won't make any sense as to what I'm doing. The first line in source number 5, the italics, is Agnon's text. Avotav va'avot avotav ayu sochrei yayin mefursamim. His fathers and his father's fathers were well-known wine merchants. Aval bitzok ha'itim yordu minichseihem. Again, they descended from their wealth in hard times. That term, tzok ha'itim, is a biblical term. It appears in one place in Tanakh, in the book of Daniel. Specifically, the verse here that I brought you, in which an angel says to Daniel about the arrival of the Messiah. He says, "Know, you should know, and you will have insight. From the issuing of the decree to restore and build Jerusalem, until the anointed prince," Mashiach in the Hebrew, 7 weeks and 62 weeks, it will return and be built roads and ramparts in times of trouble. Tzok ha'itim is a reference to times of trouble. And the reason why I highlight this is, first of all, because Agnon uses colorful phrases that he draws from Tanakh. But I think this is a piece of the references to a Mashiach, a messianic time, that on the one end you could look at and say, well, that's really interesting because the Christians emphasize that. Christians love the book of Daniel and its calculations of when the Messiah is going to come. But the part that's relevant, I think, for us primarily is that he's saying that Mashiach, the Messiah, is going to come, but in a time of suffering. When he quotes that phrase, tzok ha'itim, from Daniel, what he's saying is, the Messiah is going to come, this old man is going to have his salvation, but it's going to happen in a time of suffering. That's what he's transposing Daniel's prediction that the Messiah comes at a time of trouble, applying it to this story here with the old man. You follow what I'm trying to say? I feel like it's a little broken, but hopefully, yeah, it'll get across. If you look at source number 6, I also wanted to point out something else. it said in the English, never a happy day did he see there in his home. So the Hebrew, if you look at source number 6, I brought it for you there. Bidirazu lo ra'a tova miyamav. In this dwelling, he never saw anything good. That's what the text says. In this dwelling, he never saw anything good. Well, that line, lo ra'a tova miyamav, is from source number 6, a verse in Psalms. Ura'e b'tuv Yerushalayim kol yemei chayecha. You should see the good of Jerusalem all the days of your life. In other words, what we're saying is, in a time of redemption, you see the good of Jerusalem all the days of your life. Whereas this old man is in exile, and therefore he never sees anything good. He's placed as somebody who is in exile, who is longing for Jerusalem, and we'll see that in the story. But right now he is in Tzokaitim, the time of suffering, and he's the opposite of somebody in a redeemed state. Clear? Okay. Let's go further in the story. I'm going to share again so that people can see it. One second. Okay, there we go. So, 5 lines up from the bottom here. But since the love of the land of Israel was embedded in his heart, he made up his mind to go up to the land of Israel. And if he were found worthy, he would find for himself a grave in its dust. He wants to be buried in Israel. Not only was he sparing in his food and parsimonious in his pleasures, but he would deny himself tasting the fruit from which to make vinegar, and would take his bread with weak brew, eating less than his due. He would never have food for himself that he would enjoy. He didn't eat of things. On Mondays and Thursdays, he would fast until he got used to living on very little. And on Friday afternoons, after he had sold his vinegar and returned from town, he would sit on a stone and take the money out of his pocket, half of which he would take for sustenance, and the other half he would put into a charity box, which the Gentiles in this realm used to place at the crossroads in the hands of that man. Right? Agnon is not going to name him. The hands of that man. A simple man, he didn't know what the purpose of the box was, and thought there was no place safer than that. He's like, hey, here's a box right out there in public. No one is going to take my stuff. That's what he thinks. Copper coins he would take for his immediate requirements, and silver coins for his traveling expenses to the land of Israel, and he would make a scratch on the can for a sign. So that's his idea. He now has a vision for himself. I want to get to Israel. I want to be buried in the land. I'm going to save up as much of my money as I can in order to be able to make the journey. So a couple of notes here. Number one is the text highlights how his religious goal is really Aliyah. It's Israel. It's not about the talis and the tefillin and all. It's about being able to go to Israel. And his commitment to that echoes religious activities and pilgrimages of the past of Jews in general. In other words, his pilgrimage is another version of an ancient pilgrimage. As an example of that, did you notice him fasting Monday, Thursday, Monday? Does that remind you of anything? Susan, you're muted.
Reading the Torah,
by the way, Reading the Torah, you're right. We read it on Mondays and Thursdays. What else?
Bahab,
correct. The Bahab fasts. So some people are like, what in the world is that? I thought I knew all the fasts. So take a look at source number 7 on your sheet, please. A Mishnah from the volume of Ta'anit. It's talking about what happens if the rain in Israel is delayed. And there are special fasts with special prayers for rain. The first set of 3 fasts would be held on Monday, Thursday, Monday. And then the second set of three fasts would be Thursday, Monday, Thursday, and so on. You had an increasing set of fasts, an increasing intensity. Now, that became another practice. That was fasts for rain. But take a look at source number 8, where it became something else. In Iyar, the month that just started for us on Monday, right, on Rosh Chodesh, in the month of Iyar, people fast on the Monday, Thursday, Monday after Passover. Not immediately after Passover. We have a tradition of not fasting in the month of Nisan. But after that month, there is a tradition which you're seeing recorded here in a book from the end of the 14th century in Germany. This is, I believe, primarily an Ashkenazi practice. A fasting fasts after Passover, and so they fast after Sukkot as well. Why? Where does this come from to fast Monday, Thursday, Monday after Passover and after Sukkot? They link this to the verse from Psalms. Serve God with happiness and rejoice in trembling. Meaning, in the place where there is happiness, there shall be the trembling of a fast. In other words, you have a celebration, you have to balance it by fasting. And they also linked it to Job, a verse in Job. And keep in mind, there are a lot of similarities between Agnon's central character here, who lost his family and is suffering terribly, and Job. And it was with this passage is in the beginning of the book of Job. It talks about how his children would feast every day, each day in the house of a different child of Job. And then when they completed a circuit of feast days, Job sent and he sanctified them and he woke early in the morning. That's a typo, sorry. He woke early in the morning and brought burnt offerings according to the number of his children, saying, perhaps my children sinned. So therefore, people fast Monday, Thursday, Monday after the big holidays for atonement in case they sinned in the course of the holiday. You follow? That's what's called Bahab. It was a stronger practice in Europe pre-war. It is still done by some Jews today, but it's a very small population at this point that observes it. My point is only to show you Agnon is drawing on this practice of Monday, Thursday, Monday fasts, which originally were to draw closer to God, to appeal to God, to repent. And here, he is fasting the same fast, but as a means of saving money for Aliyah. His religion is, get me to the land of Israel. You follow? Agnon is just burying it in his story, and you could totally read the story and never get it. But it's absolutely there. That's number one, but we're not done. Did you see what it said about him splitting his money? Half for his regular mundane needs, and half to be able to get to Israel. That evokes a story from the Talmud about the sage Hillel. Take a look at source number 9. They said of Hillel the elder that daily he would work and earn a tropic, which is a coin. Half he gave to the guard of the study hall, and half for his support and the support of his household. So the same idea of splitting your income, 50% in Hillel's case was for their mundane needs, and 50% was to be able to contribute to the study hall. You know, they needed to light fire for keep everybody warm. They had certain costs, so you had to pay in order to get in. And he would use 50% of his income for that. That story, by the way, I see your hand, hang on. That story with Hillel is right before one of the more famous stories of Hillel, the one where he freezes up on the roof in the winter under the snow. He's on the roof of the study hall. That's because one day he didn't have the coin to be able to get in. So that story is part of this passage in the Talmud. But my point in bringing it is to say that this man, what Agnon is doing here, is he's drawing on the story of Hillel to say this man in the story, his religion is, again, going to Israel, just like for Hillel, studying Torah was. Yes, Ian. You're muted. I can't wait till we're back in person and I can say to somebody, you're muted, when they're just talking to me.
Does differentiate in the
Yes, that's coming right up.
Obviously denoting value of the coins.
Interesting. So I was going to say something a little different based on something in Jewish tradition. I picked up also on the copper and silver thing. Take a look at source number 10. There is a mitzvah in the Torah called Maaser Sheni. And what it means is that when you have Israeli produce, in certain years of the sabbatical cycle, you bring that produce to Jerusalem. You tithe the produce, and you bring that tithe to Jerusalem to eat there. However, if Jerusalem is too far away, you're not going to be able to make the journey, you can redeem it for money and bring the money to Jerusalem. You don't have to actually bring the fruit, and then in Jerusalem, you use the money to buy food. But, you know, there are little coins and there are big coins. Imagine that you're a farmer and you have a lot of produce to tithe. You know, carting that to Jerusalem is hard, but even the coins is not so simple. So what you want to do is change your small coins into larger coins. Copper coins tended to be the small ones. Silver coins were the large ones, right? Like 10 pennies will make up a dime and 25 will make up a quarter, that kind of thing. But there was a concern because in Talmudic times, copper coins would corrode very easily. They deteriorated. And so they didn't want the mitzvah to be cheated by using poor quality coins. So if you take a look at source number 10, the Mishnah teaches one may redeem silver coins from this Maaser Sheni, from the tithe, for copper in a case of need, but not to leave them that way. Rather, one must again redeem those for silver. You have to change them back. In other words, the copper coins are the inferior ones. The silver ones are the ones that are for the journey to Jerusalem. So now you go back to the story and you see copper coins are for his immediate requirements. Silver coins for the journey to the land of Israel. Agnon is so sharp. He's so sharp. He's drawing on here, there, and everywhere to build this up. You follow? It's really, really striking. Like you can't skip it. So what he's showing you, again, is that Agnon's religion is all about this journey to Israel. What other people fasted, his fasts are for this. Hillel spent on Torah, he spends on getting to Israel. He has these coins like they used for the tithe. He's using that in order for him to be able to get there. I'm going to note one other thing and then I'll take questions. Just one other note in the text that I think is important is that his journey to Israel, this is a spoiler for those who didn't read the story yet, his journey to Israel is going to cost him his life. It's going to cost him his life in the end of the story. I need to say that to you because we said in the text, when we were talking about his love of Israel, just want to find where it said it, where was it? Oh, it was in the beginning of this. It said, but since the love of the land of Israel was embedded in his heart. Take a look at source number 11 on your sheet, where I brought you the Hebrew. Ho'il ve'ahavat Eretz Yisrael haita tikua bilibo. Because love of the land of Israel was stabbed in his heart. And that is a biblical reference. The story of Avshalom, Absalom, David's son. He was killed by the general Yoav, or at the orders of the general Yoav. If you take a look at source number 11, he, Yoav, took three spears, Vayikach shlosha shvatim bechapo, Vayitka'em belev Avshalom. He stabbed them into the heart of Avshalom. So what Agnon is saying is that the love of Israel is stabbed into his heart. He's going to pay for it with his life. Okay, questions and comments. Susan. And then Rosalind.
Okay. You said this was written in 1923.
Published then. That means he was working on it for years before that. He worked for years on these. Yeah.
But if he had this feeling, he was still free to go back to Israel.
Yeah.
You were saying that. So why did he stay in Germany?
Oh, this is not autobiographical. I don't think this is autobiographical. I think he's writing a satire of something else.
No, I realize that, but you're saying his religion, you said said Agnon's.
Oh, no, not his religion. No, no, no. The protagonist in the story.
Oh, you meant the protagonist, yeah, yeah. Not Agnon.
Correct.
No. Oh, I thought you were.
Yeah, no. Okay. There are stories that are autobiographical. There are stories that are really about him, but this one, I believe, not in this way. Rosalind.
Hi. So I just want to go back to the first page of the story, the first paragraph. I'm just not certain. He says, the sentence that begins, "Now that my wife is dead and my progeny is no more, why do I take such pains to draw my skin from my flesh?"
Yes.
Is that because of the vinegar? I mean, it's a very Christian allusion about, you know, on yourself.
It's funny that you mentioned it, because I also, that caught my eye, and I thought of different, there are different rabbinic passages that he could be alluding to with that, you know, with that turn of phrase. I didn't go into it because I you know, in general, in preparing this, I was afraid of going too far and, you know, down the rabbit hole of his allusions. But I think what he, you could read it as Christian. The term in the Hebrew was Moshech Orim Mibisari, drawing, it's translated fairly well there, drawing my skin from my flesh is a fair translation. But I think what he's referring to on a literal level is the acidity of the vinegar and the strain that he's going through. I think that's really what this is about.
And just one more quick question. The Nobel acceptance speech that he gives, is he speaking in English or in German or in Hebrew?
So I don't remember, because I did look into that at one point. I know that it was done with translation for the King of Sweden, meaning he didn't present it in Swedish. I believe it was in Hebrew. I believe the original is in Hebrew, but on the Nobel site, they don't have the original.
Yeah, but when I read it, I didn't know what language he was speaking. I thought he was speaking German for some reason, but right. Probably not.
No, it would have been most likely Hebrew. Okay.
I think
Agnon
left Germany because his library had a fire in his house, and his whole library burnt, and he figured that was a message from the Almighty that he had to come back.
Yes.
But I thought it was in 1924 that he returned to Israel. I may be wrong.
So, as I understand it, it is 1924 when he comes back to Israel. That's true. That was what we had said, yeah. Yes, Moish.
You know, we have to remember that this is first and foremost literature, and not necessarily any more than that. Look at this story. He cannot find a means of saving his own money other than this Christian almsbot that he doesn't know anything about.
Yep.
And ultimately, that is the source of his getting to Israel. So the story is really a story of literature, and remember literature and make of it what you mean.
So I would take issue with a phrase that you used when you say only literature and nothing more. There's no such thing in any writer, and certainly not in Agnon. He makes it more obvious in some stories, less obvious in others, but you'll see as we read through this story, there's no missing the religious overtones and the Christian element in this. It's so here. I got a thumbs up from the professor of literature. I saw that, Cole. You know, I'm sorry, just I mentioned in the beginning that I'm really short on time because I need to be at the Yom HaZikaron program, so I'm going to stop with that right now. I want to go one more piece in this story, and then we'll pause. So go back to the story where it says, from then on. It says, I'm going to start sharing it again. From then on, he labored with joy. You see where I am here, I'm just highlighting it. Lo and behold, he would say to himself, up to now I disliked my trade, and now I find it hard to give it up. The same utensils, the same vinegar, and before I know it, the day is done. At midnight he would get up from his bed, take his can, and dance about with it until it was time for morning prayers. The more he was occupied with his calculations of how many scratches there were on the can and how much money he had put in the charity box, so his prayers suffered, becoming somewhat erratic. And so said he, O God, it is plain for you to see that all the calculations I make are only so that I may go up to your land. Take me there, and I will say to you a fine prayer. I'm going to pray to you, God, but I'm going to do it in the land. That's what I'm going to do. Now, I want to note a couple of things quickly before I have to break here. First of all, you notice that he's rising at midnight, right? This is a practice which is known traditionally as Tikkun Chatzot, where Jews would rise at midnight. It's based, if you look at source number 12 in the Talmud in Brachot, based off of a verse in Psalms, in which King David says, at midnight I rise to thank you, God, for the laws of your justice. Chatzot Laila Akum. So until midnight, we are taught in the Talmud, King David would involve himself in Torah, and from then on he would sing songs and praises to God. That's the passage in the Talmud. In the Shulchan Aruch, in the Code of Jewish Law, and I brought you a comment from Rabbi Yisrael Meir Kagan in his Mishneh Berurah commentary to the Code of Jewish Law. It says, the Kabbalists went on at great length regarding the value of rising at midnight to mourn for the temple, for it is great. It was particularly a matter of rising to grieve for the temple, and he is rising at midnight in joy about the possibility of going to the land of Israel. He is dancing. He's not grieving and crying. He is dancing. And not only that, we're going to see more about the dancing, but the last note that I'll make here, it said in the English, his prayers become somewhat erratic. That's one of the translations I really don't like, because he cheats you of Agnon's brilliance. Take a look at source number 14. The Hebrew in the text says, Hayam mitpalel, he would pray, velo dikdek ba'otioteha, he was not precise with the letters. That's what the Hebrew says. So what? That's a Mishnah in source number 14, which talks about somebody who recites Shema, kara velo dikdek ba'otioteha, someone who recites Shema and is not precise with the letters, and there's a debate whether you fulfill your mitzvah or not. So what you're seeing here is that this protagonist is praying, but he's not being precise with the letters, which in the Talmud is grounds for arguing maybe you didn't actually fulfill it. To this man, everything has become subsumed under the desire to make it to Israel. That's all that matters to him and is his journey. There's much more to say, and I apologize again for having to cut it short, but we have the program here that I didn't realize was going to conflict, and so I need to be in the program for Yom HaZikaron, for Israel's Memorial Day. However, like I said, we're going to make up the time with extra another week if we need to, but we are going to go through this story properly, God willing. I apologize for any rushing that I did today. Hold the thoughts and questions. I will send out a link later for the recording.
Don't worry.
I expect.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much,
Thank
everybody.
You. Thank you.
And be well.
Pray for the memories of